What's up? Welcome to another episode of All Over Voiceover with Kip VH. I'm your host, Kip VH. And with me, I'm very excited to welcome my guest. You've heard me talk about him and his work before on the show. Dr. Don Green is with us. Don, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to be here.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you, Kip. Pleasure to be here.
As I've got so many questions and so much to sort of unpack, I've spent probably more time in your work, especially over the past year and a half, really between the Winning on Stage course, the your books, all of it. I've just been taking it all in, and I thought it would be wonderful to share your perspective on so many different aspects of performance with my audience. So,
sure.
Just to start things off, can you tell us, like, how'd you get started becoming a specialist in performance?
Yeah, I grew up actually with a fear of public speaking.
Really?
In grammar school, yeah. And I didn't like to be called on in class or never raise my hand. When I was about 3 or 4, I got diagnosed with a speech impediment that I couldn't pronounce certain sounds like the GR sound.
Really?
So when people asked my name, I laughed.
Yeah.
And after a while, I really didn't want to, I was embarrassed. And that kept me, you know, all through grammar school, high school, even college. One of my last presentations, just a short speech to my classmates at West Point that I've been through 4 years with and heaven and hell with. And it was on my major on Revolutionary Warfare and Che Guevara, and I couldn't sleep for a week beforehand.
Oh my gosh.
I got up there and I blanked out, I stuttered. I don't know how I got through it, but it didn't stop there for me. All through the Army and graduate school. And I went to a Toastmasters one time in San Diego, where, you know, you bring your brown bag lunch and sit around the conference table with other scared people. Before they got to me, I left.
Really? So you have this awareness of yourself and that particular fear. And obviously you go through the military, you go to graduate school, you're dealing like with this high level stuff, but that particular thing was an Achilles heel. Is that what led you to Toastmasters? Like, I want to go and work on this thing that's like an impediment for me. Is that what draws?
Oh, for sure. That's what I wanted to solve.
Yeah.
But, I wasn't ready to deal with that.
Huh.
But then I started a PhD program in sports psychology. Really? And I learned about controlling nervousness and centering and focusing. And that's when I learned how to do it.
Amazing.
And now I love it. I've given Toastmasters and 1,000 people. I've been on TV. I love it.
Yeah.
I still get a tingling of nerves, but I've come to enjoy that.
I agree. Yes.
So that, that's how I came to it first with athletes, and then started working with musicians. And that led to other folks like comedians and public speakers, Toastmasters, those kind of things.
Yeah.
That's got guys about to give a toast at a wedding or some ministers who were really worried about this, presentation there.
Yeah.
Homily on Sunday, just a whole range of people. I mean, this is number one fear in the country. Number one fear is public speaking. Number two is death of a spouse. So most people at a funeral would rather be in the coffin than have to give a eulogy.
Right.
So, I just got an appreciation that, it's a lot of people.
Yeah.
Especially people that are shy introverts.
Hmm.
And I was a shy introvert.
What can you talk about that? You're taking all the information in during the PhD program and learning, getting your doctorate in sports psychology, and then taking that out to helping to teach it. Like, it's one thing to learn it; it's another to help guide people along. What was that process for you as a teacher?
Well, excuse me. I had been teaching for many years.
Mm.
I started out teaching third and fifth grade PE.
Really?
Yeah.
When was this? Was this like right after you got out of the Army and stuff, or while?
No,
you...
this is later in my career.
Okay.
But my master's degree is in forensic science.
Really?
Yeah. I was a detective for like 8 years.
No kidding.
Yeah. And my master's is from George Washington, one of the best schools in the world for forensic science. And I did that for a number of years until I had enough of it. Yeah. And I was looking basically for a program in forensic psychology.
Hmm.
And I discovered they had a program in sports psychology. And I thought, there it is. That's what I've been looking for. So I switched over immediately and got my degree. And the first job I got out of my graduate program, I was with the Olympic diving team, 1984 Olympic diving team.
Oh, man. That's fascinating. My wife's an athlete. What was that experience like, being at the Olympics and working with the Olympic team and on their diving skill and the mental game?
Well, it was an amazing dream for me because I was a diver. That was my sport.
Really?
In high school and college. Yeah. I was nationally ranked springboard diver. And so here I was with the coach that was my dream coach, Ron O'Brien from Ohio State, now at Mission Viejo. And this amazing team of 14 divers, including Greg Louganis, Michelle Mitchell, and Wendy Weiland, and Megan Nyer. And all of a sudden, I worked with them for a couple months, and then we were at the Olympics.
Incredible.
And it was just amazing. Like, oh my God, incredible. Yeah.
That's amazing. So you've told this story in your book about mental practice. In particular, as it applied to diving, would you share that story with us about the diver who she? Well, it's better for you to tell than for me to summarize.
Sure, sure. Well, this was a couple of months before the Olympic trials, and one of the divers was the youngest diver on the team, was 16. How she qualified for the Olympic trials, I don't know, but they thought, you know, it'd be a good experience. In 4 years, maybe she'll. So she was up on 10 meter, which is
yeah,
very high.
Like 30 feet, right?
33 feet.
33 feet.
And you know, if you think of the high board at the local pool, that's 3 meters. This is 10 meters.
Wow.
And you hit the water at 35 miles an hour. It's a violent explosion. It's pretty rough. When I used to dive, I'd do about 10 dives before I got a pretty strong headache.
Wow.
Yeah, it's tough. Anyway, so she was doing a back 2.5 on 10 meter. Back 2.5 is where you turn around backwards on a platform and then somersault backwards, but in the pike position, which is slower than the tuck position. It's
okay.
Yes, slow rotation. And even though you're 10 meters up, you still need to jump and start the spin to make the rotation. It's a lot.
Yeah.
And she didn't. Instead of jumping, she kind of sat back and started falling like a rock. But she stayed within her pike, slowly rotating. And it was painful. We could see it coming. I was right next to the coach. We were both about to cringe. And a more experienced diver would have just rolled up into a ball and held on for dear life.
Yeah.
It's pretty good that way. She stuck with her spots. You know, you see the first spot and then the second, then you kick out. Well, she was used to kicking out, you know, 3 meters above, so then you can continue the rotation and bring the dive in.
Yeah.
Well, she was only like a foot off the water.
Oh.
And she hit absolutely flat. Like she bounced. The water's kind of hard at that point. Yeah. So we got the stretcher under her, threw a towel over and took her to the hospital. All the tests, the orthopedic surgeon comes in and says, I don't know why your back isn't broken, but it isn't. You're going to be very sore for many days. So like young Olympic hopefuls all over the world, bless them, she says, yes, but can I still dive at the trials?
Right.
Young lady, oh my God. Well, he said, maybe. He said, but you can't dive until then. So every day at practice, I was in the coach's office. She was on the couch. And we were going through her workouts, mentally rehearsing her dives, not just her, that dive, but all the dives, not just that, even stretching and warming up, just keeping her mind in it.
Yeah.
Like she would be doing it and do lead up dives and 5 meter platform dives, like a regular workout. And also that dive and correcting that dive. And, you know, we did that for over a month. Then we went to Indianapolis for the trials a week early. So we get used to the pool and the lightings and the spots and all. And the surgeon came with us, orthopedic surgeon, and she said, can I do my warm-up dives? He says, no.
Wow.
So for a week, all she and I did was go to trainer's room, lay down, let's go through them again. And also we went up on the platform and looked down and, you know, looked at the spots and got used to the rubber matting, the Mondo surface.
Yeah.
The day of the trials came and she says, can I at least do my 8 dives warm up? She says, no, all you can do is do your 8 dives in a contest. That's all your back will stand, maybe.
Wow.
Well, she hadn't done these dives for over a month and platform diving is crazy. If you're away from it for a weekend, you believe I can't do that anymore. Just, wow. It's really scary.
Yeah.
So she got up and she hit her first dive. And people were blown away. Diving community is very small. Everybody knew the story of this girl. These were the first dives in a month.
Yeah.
It's the second dive. The third dive, the fourth dive. She's leading the contest. She's beating all the Olympic athletes and champions, world champions, national champions. 6 dives, she's winning by a bunch. She's going to be the story of the games.
Yeah.
Absolutely the story of the games.
Yeah.
Sports Illustrated cover, I could see it. On the 7th dive, which was not the tough dive, by later in a contest with all the girls going up with, you know, wet and all that, the platform gets wet, the Mondo gets slippery.
Yeah.
And she didn't take it into account. She hadn't been diving in months.
Yeah.
She didn't factor that in.
Yeah.
So she slipped off the platform.
Oof.
And got in. She didn't do a dive. She couldn't complete a dive. And she went in at a bad angle. And the orthopedic surgeon looked at her and pulled her out of the contest.
Yeah.
But it made me a firm believer in the power of mental rehearsal. Because as a diver, I never used it.
Huh.
I at the time I was like 12 and I was doing a front 1.5 on low board. Uh-huh. And I kept on coming out and doing belly flops. And one of the other divers said, hey, why don't you try to picture it? I tried to picture it. All I saw was myself doing belly flops. Right. I thought, that's not such a good idea. I didn't realize I was doing it wrong. Uh-huh. And it's very easy to learn how to do it right. But that's why I never did it myself.
I mean, it really underlines, too, like as you're describing it, how critical all those minute details are, too, right, to the mental practice?
Oh, yeah. It's got to be vivid and not just visual. It's got to be, especially for your folks, it's got to be auditory.
Yes.
Hopefully kinesthetic, not too high cognitive.
Right.
Yeah. And you go through it in your head. I don't personally believe in memorizing lines. I'm not a trained actor.
Uh-huh.
They need to memorize lines. I don't do it that way. I've got my own way of giving presentations.
How do you manage your presentations without line memorization? What's your process?
Well, keep in mind, lines are in left brain. It's cognitive.
Yes.
Words and numbers in left brain. Right brain is where we hear sounds, feel sensations like good breathing, and have pictures in our head. But there's no words. It's mentally quiet.
Yeah.
But focus is mentally quiet for most things. I mean, if you're giving a speech, you're going to have some noise, but sure, it shouldn't be overly left brain dominant. So my feeling is, no matter how long the presentation is, it needs to be chunked into three parts. That's generally the attention span of most people and most speakers. Hello. So three chunks, depending upon the size, okay? But then I'm a firm believer that they should be bubbles, visual pictures, okay?
Yeah.
And the way I see it is like you went on this summer vacation, and now you want to share the pictures of your summer vacation. First slide, here I am packing up the car. Well, you know how to talk about packing up the car. Right. Just come on, talk about packing up the car. And then the next slide, here you are arriving at the lake. Oh, it's a beautiful lake. Just look at it. You know that.
Right.
Then here I am driving home. Shit, we had a great time, but I don't want to go home. Because what you have in there, because people think in pictures, you got to paint the picture.
Yes.
That takes words. But I mean, if you've seen the picture, you can describe that's your car.
Right.
But also the emotions are very important. And they kind of underlie the bubbles. You have to have an emotional tone. People want to hear about emotions.
Yeah.
They can take facts for a while. Yeah, okay, you went to this place and this place and this place. Well, let's hear about the time you fell down the cliff. Was it scary? Oh. Sounds like fun to me.
Yeah, let me see that bubble where you're calling the ambulance.
What'd that feel like?
Yeah. What'd that feel like? No, just moan. Don't give me any audible sounds. That's so fascinating.
So that to me is that's what I see. And just make sure the pictures are really clear.
Yeah.
And you're not ad-libbing the emotions. You might want to, that's tricky because emotions are tricky. But that's easy enough to specify.
That's great. I've been using to memorize for self-tapes and auditions and things of that nature. I've been memorizing using the Memory House device, which is take the house that you grew up in. Take a house that you could walk through blindfolded. And then at each specific location, attach an image, not words, but an image based on the text of the dialogue. And then convert so it's been, you know, going from one shocking, memorable image to the next through my mother's office into the kitchen, and that the path through the house, like walking through a museum, looking at these bizarre things, helps me connect to the story. The challenge with that is, or that I keep bumping into, is exactly what you just described of like the emotional truth of what the line is supposed to be. How does that necessarily align to the picture? So like my, does that make sense?
We can do this.
Okay. So
when I was at Juilliard,
yes,
I had a piano faculty member come to me and said, I've got a recital coming up for my students. And the last time I had a recital for my students, I had a severe memory break. This faculty member had to stop in the middle of his concert, or it was just whatever it was, leave the stage, go get the music, come back on stage, put the music on the music, and continue playing.
Oh, man.
Mortified. Shoot me now. So he says, can you help me with that? And I said, yeah, it's going to take some time. So when I was working with ski instructors, they made a lot of money on tips. And the tips were based upon their camaraderie with the students, rapport.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, these were high-end students, you know, can afford bail.
Yeah.
And the last thing they want is somebody to mess up their name. Like, hey, you the guy with the red top. It's like, right. There goes the tip right there.
Right, exactly.
So I got into memory and started studying memory systems and how to memorize names. And I came up with my own system for that.
Oh, man.
So then I went to Vail, and I went to, I'm sorry, Juilliard with this piano teacher. And I started applying what I knew from all the memory systems I learned. There's several different systems.
Okay.
And you need the right system.
Yeah.
And every week I met with two faculty members, one that basically taught music theory and ear training. She's very accomplished and knew music backwards and forwards, but she didn't have an answer to this one. Hmm. And another teacher that was a concert pianist who learned music the way most people do, just, play it over and over and over and over.
Yeah, yeah.
And, rote learning's okay to a certain level, but it gets boring. And it's not creative, and it's not that effective.
Hmm.
So some of it's going, like you said, with the rooms, okay?
Yeah.
But let's do it with my system, if you will.
Please.
And can we work on something you would like to apply to right now?
Yes. Let me grab a piece. Do I need copy?
Yes.
All right. Let me I can conjure something up. Let me go to an old audition.
I've never done this before with actors per se, or voiceover people per se.
Awesome.
It's a little bit tricky because it's got the left brain component.
Okay.
Only needs to be a paragraph. It's
yeah.
Not long.
Perfect. I'll bring up a piece that I'm working on for a class right now, and I'll scroll down to this paragraph about Dino Mutt and Blue Falcon, cartoon characters. Okay. Got it.
Can you show it to me?
I sure can. I am sharing my screen.
We're going to have some fun with this.
Yeah, I'm excited. This is great. I'm giving this as a presentation next week at UCLA, and we're going to do this particular paragraph here. And it's Dino Mutt always backfires.
Okay, let's just stick with this, okay?
Great. Perfect.
Can we cut this up?
Uh-huh.
And break it up.
You bet. What's a good place to break it up? At the
pyramids? That's what I'm looking for.
Okay.
Where it says, get them out.
Okay.
And put a period there and then bring that next sentence, bring it down and then add it to the next one.
Uh-huh.
We're going to cut that one. After chest.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. This is going to be fun.
Amazing.
Okay. Now, this is not limited and endless piece of music.
Right.
It has no limit any more than all the people whose faces in your life you remember.
Huh.
You may not remember the names, but those faces are in there.
Yeah.
They're in your right brain and not in your left brain. Long-term memory is right brain, not left brain. That's why you meet somebody at a cocktail party. They introduce a name, you walk away, come back 14 seconds later, you forgot the name. I know what you look like. Okay, here we go.
Right.
All right. So can we do a reading, please?
Yes. Dino Mutt always backfires on Blue Falcon. If Blue Falcon were ice skating, Dino Mutt would skate super fast around him and accidentally cut a hole in the ice around Blue Falcon, who would fall in, that Dino Mutt would try to get him out. But grab his feet rather than his arms and dunk him repeatedly like a biscotti in a cafe latte. If Blue Falcon were eating an ice cream cone, Dino Mutt would add toppings to make it tastier and shoot sprinkles, whipped cream, and salsa out of his chest. These are the rules of the world.
This is too ideal. This is too ideal. Okay, we're going to break it up again.
Okay.
Another line, right after Blue Falcon. Let's drop that line down. Yes.
Okay.
Right after accidentally. After then. Oh, then. Fell in.
Fell in then.
Then. Yep. Oh, this is going to be so cool. Put if blue down. After tastier. Let's stop there, okay?
Okay, you bet.
Just erase the rest.
Okay.
Now, here's where it gets to be fun. Okay, yeah. So we have seven different kind of bubbles, if you will.
Yes.
So what I want you to imagine is a journey that you took all the time that was always the same, but, for a friend's house or teacher's house or job,
uh-huh.
But there was only one route and it had specific locations in between. This is kind of like your house.
Okay. Yes.
Okay? So the first picture right next to Dynamout is your front door.
Okay. Got it.
So put front door next to that.
Okay. Front or back? Doesn't matter.
Front. Well, that, whatever you can picture.
Okay.
If it's the door, back to it, put back to it.
I see what you mean.
It's your picture.
Yes. It's the front door. It's the front door.
It's your front door.
So got it.
Now for the last one, where you're shooting sprinkles.
Yes.
Where might that be? That's your destination.
Okay.
What would that be?
That's the school.
There we go. What part of the school?
It's the parking lot at my high school.
That's what parking lot. Okay. Now, fill in the blanks with logical steps that are always the same, never change, and different locations, different kind of scenes.
Gotcha. So this is top of Martin Street and 72nd.
Good. Okay.
And I'm going to make a make a left down to Eastern and 72nd.
Is that another intersection?
Yes.
Good. Okay.
Then we have the Marathon Station.
Good.
Then, the Rustic Market.
I love it.
And then right here is 68th and Division.
Wonderful. Okay. So go through that in your mind. Boom, okay. Boom, boom. See those places.
Uh-huh.
Do it again. Okay. Now here's what I want you to do. I want you to picture yourself at the front door. Okay?
Uh-huh.
And say that line to yourself. Okay?
Yep.
Same thing with the next. The next, go through it at each place. Connect the dots. You've got to connect the right brain picture to the right brain sounds. This is what we're building in long-term memory.
Yeah.
Now, at the front door, I want you to see the Blue Falcon backfiring.
Okay. Yep.
And hear the words. More connections.
Yes.
See the Falcon skating around super fast.
Uh-huh.
Around 72nd Street.
Mm-hmm.
Continue with that. A hole.
There's a hole.
On Eastern and 72nd. Put a hole in the ground.
Yep.
Hear the words. Dynamite. Trying to get them out at the station out of the hole with saying the words. And then, tell me when you're at the parking lot.
Okay. Dynamite's eating it. Blue Falcon's eating an ice cream cone. Dynamite is trying to add toppings at corner of 68th and Division, right in the middle of the intersection.
There you go.
And then there's sprinkles and whipped cream and salsa shooting out of Dynamite's chest in my parking
lot. There you go. Yeah. Okay. One of the basis of memory is always repetition and rote, but this is not rote. This is creative. This brings up all parts of your mind and creative parts. It's really, you'll see, we're not even close to being done.
Yeah.
Now at each place, at each location, besides Dynamo doing all that stuff, there's an actor there. One of the actors whose voice you respect the most.
Hmm.
And you're going to hear that actor say those lines while you're at that location. Okay?
Yes.
You do this in your head. I don't want to try to impersonate Sir Laurence Olivier or Robert De Niro.
Right.
But whoever you think would kind of fit that place.
All right. Is it a different voice at each location?
Different person.
Excellent.
Yeah. You need seven actors or voice people that you really respect.
Perfect. I'll put Harrison Ford at the front door.
There you go.
Dynamite always backfires on Blue Falcon.
I love it.
Nicolas Cage at Martin Street, Eastern and 72nd. De Niro. Al Pacino. At Marathon Station. Morgan Freeman. Okay.
Okay. Now here comes an interesting part.
Okay.
You're going to go through it again, but you're allowed to look at the words. Of course, you want them to get the words right, like you were feeding them their lines.
Gotcha.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, but be patient with these guys.
Yes. They're A-list talent. I can't get angry at Nicolas Cage for not remembering.
Right. Okay. Have fun.
All right. Quick producer's note. I did all this in real time with Don, so I cut it down for the purpose of the show, but all this work I'm doing mentally. So each of these steps took about a minute.
Now go through it in your head. Don't refer and just see how much you know or don't. Try it out.
Okay. Man, I'm like at 90%.
Okay, that's really good. Now what I want you to do to make them a little bit more prominent is make them kind of put in silly costumes or kind of not doing the greatest job with the lines, just kind of like these people are messing up.
Okay.
Humor is a very important part of this process. It really is. That really helps. So if you if you see it funny, it will stick out in your mind. We're not going to end with this. Just another step.
Okay.
Okay. Next is an exaggerated emotion. Whatever the emotion is, you know, if it's sad, really sad. If it's happy, like silly happy.
Okay. And this is the actor is carrying that emotion, right?
Yes. 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 Okay. Now here's the final step.
Okay.
You step into the scene with them and say, nah, that's not that good. Let me show you how to do it. And then hear the best voice, the absolute best quality voice. But, you know, for each, let a little bit of them in, you know, but we've got different themes here.
Yes.
So let's now tie all the components together.
All right.
And let them just sit there and listen to you.
Great. Am I doing this mentally or am I doing this out loud?
You're doing it first mentally, then you're going to do it out loud.
Okay. Dynamite always backfires on Blue Falcon. If Blue Falcon were ice skating, Dynamite would skate circles around him really quick, accidentally cutting a hole in the ice, and Blue Falcon would fall in. Dynamite would help him out, but rather than grab him by the arms, he grabs him by the legs and starts rapidly dunking him like biscotti in a iced cafe latte. If Blue Falcon was eating an ice cream cone, Dynamite would shoot toppings at him to try to make it tastier, and he would shoot sprinkles and whipped cream and salsa out of his chest.
Awesome.
Amazing.
Ready? Kiff, you ready?
Yeah.
Do it backwards.
He would shoot sprinkles, whipped cream, and salsa out of his chest. If Blue Falcon were eating an ice cream cone, Dynamite would want to give him toppings to make it tastier. But instead of grabbing his arms, he's grabbing his legs.
Okay, got the idea?
Totally. I had to think about it. And it's tied to emotion. It's tied to specificity. It's tied to locations. There's so many. That's fascinating, Don, because it's like, it's not just one thing that I'm grabbing onto, and if I don't get the one thing, I'm lost. I've got seven things. I've got
environment, just it. Because, right? And the one thing is usually a cognitive thing, and that's the weakest point in the memory link.
Yeah. Wow. Wow.
That was fun.
That was fun. Now you have another, like, to be able to apply that with words and with actors and other touch points. How did you know how to break up the script? What were you looking for? Was it like inorganic places?
I was looking for natural breaks and also visual breaks. When I saw that piece, it's very visual laden. I mean, a lot there.
Yes.
And it's a little bit trickier than like phrases and music.
Yes.
That's trickier. But musicians can find it when the themes change or there's a change in the key or the tempo changes, and that's where it is. But this had so many visual images, but that's what you want anyway. You don't want to throw out words. You want to throw out images and sensations and feelings and humor and emotions.
Yes.
That's what makes a great speech.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. This was something that when I first started trying to transpose your work with, in particular in the book, Performance Success, transpose your work with musicians to this work of being a voice performer. And, you know, I'm in my studio and I wanted to figure out what my daily practice was going to consist of, because, you know, as you lay in there about daily practice, there's mental practice, there's you know, sight readings, or not necessarily sight reading stuff, but like, I mean, you know, all the things that you know. I'm trying to paraphrase for the audience because they don't have the benefit necessarily of reading everything I've read of yours. But like, what does daily practice look like? And for someone who is auditioning, that was the thing. Because in the book, it's about preparing for the audition. But in VO, I audition daily, multiple times over, often with very little lead-in time for it. So part of me was like, well, there's your daily practice, the lazy part of me. But it's like, I don't, that's not really practice because there's stakes on that, everything from a national commercial to a animated series. So I wanted to see what your take is or what your thought is in terms of what a daily practice for a voiceover actor might look like. And I'm, you know, I'm happy to provide you any details about being a VO actor. If, you know,
I've worked with a few.
Really?
Yeah.
Terrific.
I always believe in routines, morning routines, you know, the first 20 minutes you get up to start your day off right with a structure, maybe walk, maybe jog, fresh air, water, limbering, stretching, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because it's an athletic event. I mean, it's, I think of all of it as, you know, you're under pressure, you want to do your best, there's moving parts, it's not easy.
Yes.
So that, whatever that would be, then I guess warming up, you know, vocalizing, if you do that. At some point, I would always be looking to expand the voice.
Hmm.
Try different tones, different phrasings, different speeds, different, all of that. Always play with it. There's a book out called The Alter Ego Effect.
The Alter Ego Effect.
Todd Herman.
Okay.
And it talks about, especially for shy, introverted people, how to develop this alter ego that does the auditions for the shy person.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. And it's a pretty good book. And you just give that character its own identity, but its own attributes, like you're very aggressive, like you're loud and outspoken, or, you know, whatever it is. And you build that character with a name and a particular way of dressing even and moving, and you send that person to the audition for you. And it, for a lot of people, it's very effective.
Yeah.
I was working with a girl in England that's a trumpet player at the university and very shy and all of that. She just was playing defensive trumpet, and you can't play defensive trumpet, it doesn't work. So she's a delightful girl, but very shy, and so we developed this character named Polly that was kind of loud and outspoken and dresses kind of loosely. She was very conservative and spoke with an American accent.
Oh, wow.
And I said, I want you to take her to an apartment store that you've never been, never go again. They don't know you.
Yeah.
They don't know you're acting different, and play it out. Don't buy anything. Just try it out.
Yeah.
She really loved it. And I think the same thing, that you develop different personas in your head.
Yeah.
That can be very effective. The one voiceover guy, I remember, I was living in New York, and he was coming up from Baltimore every week to talk to me about this. And he was a shy introvert, but then he was not talking fast enough. All those ones where you get all of those words in the last 10 seconds.
That legal copy,
So I said, you know what, I want you, when you're coming up here, stand on a railway station as close as you can get to it, and the train's going by you. Just get really close to them, and then start talking real fast, without a regard for diction or accuracy. Just don't fall into the train.
Yes.
And he got faster and faster and faster, and it's also with the imagery, you know.
That's
because the right brain is instantaneous. The left brain is very slow to work, you know, words and sequence and meter and pacing. That's very slow. You picture something in your head, it's there.
Yeah.
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 So he got fast.
That's so fascinating. The human brain and how that stuff works is just unreal. Oh, it's so cool. I'm running out of time with you, Don. There's a couple things because of that marvelous exercise. Let me. I'm just gonna run down my list of questions. I'm glad I wrote them down. Can you talk from one of the things I hear so many actors struggle with in particular is that notion of, well, we're always facing rejection and this and sort of the combination of that with maybe rejection isn't necessarily linked to this. But negative self-talk. The quote unquote imposter syndrome that I feel a lot of very successful VO people have, where they have this sense of, you know, by some lucky break, I was given a shot and I don't deserve it and I'm fooling everybody. Like, how do you extinguish that fire that erodes your sort of pillars of confidence? What strategy is there to address that?
Well, that's basically fear. Fear of rejection, fear of not getting the job, all of that. And you do it by understanding that's normal, it's just not helpful. And you continually build your courage by putting yourself in risky situations of doing auditions, trying a new approach at auditions. Hmm. Audition on a street corner, just
yeah.
One of my Juilliard students had problems with external distractions, their homework assignments, right? They would go down to the subway platform and play their instrument on a subway platform with people walking by, and after all, nothing bothered them. Wow. You do what scares you, or you do what distracts you, or you do what you have trouble with, not avoid it, that continues the problem. Whatever it is, like with my public speaking, I just try to keep on doing it, and now it's not a problem.
Yeah. Oh, man. Fantastic. I've talked about this on this show. I landed a series regular on a cartoon series, and I credit it directly to your centering work.
Yes.
Because it helped me mitigate the anxiety of the moment and focus and detach from the expectation of what I wanted and connect instead to what I wanted to accomplish and what specific performance goals I had for myself. Can you talk about, I haven't gone into detail about it, but can you talk about that particular meditation or experience of centering and the impact of that?
Sure. When I was talking about learning sports psychology, what I was specifically talking about was learning centering. I learned how to center before I gave a presentation. That changed everything.
And that was something you learned in college or during?
No, I learned in my graduate
studies. In your graduate studies.
By the man who invented it, who combined Eastern and Western. He went to Japan, got his black belt in Aikido, which is one of the most mental of all the martial arts, and came back and got his PhD in performance psychology. And he combined the two of them to create centering. It takes a while to learn. It's a 7-step process, pretty involved. At first takes about a minute and a half. After you practice, you go from the basic to intermediate to advanced, which you can be done in like 10 seconds, standing, sitting, moving.
Yeah.
So this is what I have musicians do before they start playing an audition, athletes before they compete in the Olympics. It's the strategy that I teach. It's the main one.
Yeah.
And I can't teach it. It takes a person from the cognitive left brain in what's called high speed beta, where you're thinking way too much, and shifts them into right brain, mental quiet, back to what we were saying before, imagining it going well, hearing your voice, feeling good breath, while also dropping tension, because most people are tight in pressure situations. They tighten up. And if the voice tightens up, it sounds different. It doesn't sound good. And they hear it, and then it tightens up more. Yeah. So centering's there to preclude this and also really get you breathing correctly, some good oxygen to your brain. It takes about 2 weeks to learn.
Yeah.
And I've got a centering course on my website, the centering course. It comes with a workbook and audio and videos. So in 2 weeks, she could really learn how to center.
Yeah.
And that's something that, you know, if I'm going to work with an artist, that's one of the first things I need to teach you how to do.
Yeah.
It takes care of a lot of issues.
Boy. That's the course I took was the 2 week course on your site, and it's absolutely transformative, and I can't recommend it enough. I'll put a link. Obviously, there's a link in the thing. Of course, it's been so helpful to. One other question for you, about resilience, like this. This particular path for all artists, for all of us who are working as a freelance sort of a situation, you know, the path of between maintaining a level of growing in your path, but also maintaining success and mitigating your fear. Like, how can you what are tips or beyond tips? Tips sound so. This is me judging myself. Talk to me about resilience. I know it's.
Let's talk about this.
Let's talk about resilience. We're in it. Been doing it for a while. Like, what does it take?
Well, it's not easy. You know, nothing worthwhile is really easy.
That's right.
You know, if you could just phone it in, it'd be nice. But this is an essential quality. Mm-hmm. This is really what differentiates those that make it from those that fall short. You go in the extra mile, and having, first of all, a vision of a real, where are you going with this? Because without a vision, a long-term vision, all you see is obstacles, and there's plenty of obstacles.
Yeah.
But once you have the vision, you can see past the obstacles because they're going to be there.
Yeah.
And we're, you know, find a way to work around it. But if you have the vision and it's worthwhile, you'll find a way. Where there's a will, there's a way. But it's hard without a vision to have a will of trying to get to someplace that you don't know. And obviously, strong desire, passion. Hopefully, you're really passionate about this, that you do it even if you didn't get paid, but get better at it so you can get paid. It's going good.
It's much better when you get paid.
And kind of map out a strategy of what you need to do and what you're deficient in. You know, do you need to see an addiction specialist? Do you need to see a breath specialist? Do you need to get in better physical shape? You know, map out a plan. So 3 months, 6 months, a year from now, you're much better.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, continue to build your courage by taking healthy risks, talking, you know, going in front of a star and say, hey, could I read you these lines? Yeah, yeah. And get used to that high energy because it should be high energy.
Yeah.
And that's what wins auditions, is enthusiasm and power in your voice, not pushing it down. Nobody wants to hear a boring drone speech. We want to hear some excitement. We want to hear some fireworks going off.
Right.
And get used to that. That's uncomfortable for some people. Mm. That was for me. Mm. When I used to teach in Juilliard, I would have really talented female Asian violinists who, once they started playing, would just blow you away. You'd think there was just a gorilla holding this instrument.
Yeah.
But you could barely hear them. I would have them stand at the other side of the thing and say, name your piece, your instrument, your name. I say, louder. No, louder. I'm not gonna stop until it's louder.
Right. That's great. Directing at Second City, I'd have my actors on stage, and the Second City here in Los Angeles, the stage is it's a shallow room. It's maybe four rows of chairs, but it's wider than it is deep. But for many of my students, they had never been on stage before. It was the first time on stage. And that was the note that I would make a point of going in there in the class at some point where we had access to it and saying, if you can't hear yourself bouncing off that back wall like bat sonar, you're not loud enough. We cannot hear you.
That's it.
And you have to learn to come to the edge of the stage, own it, be present. This is you are what they're here.
That's where the alter ego comes in with people that are uncomfortable with that. That's a really good use of that, and to play with that, because that's what necessary. I love to speak.
Awesome.
I do. That's one of the things. That's one of the things that I've missed is being on stage.
Yeah,
I really got to like it. So you want to hear one story?
Yes, please.
A few years ago, I had to have serious back surgery from athletic injuries. Anyway, I was out for a while. And a school in Texas, Sam Houston State, contacted me and said, we'd like you to be part of our STEAM something lecture series. We start off the year every year with this. In the past, it's been like Dan Rather, who went to school there.
Okay.
And a couple of famous opera singers and people in the arts.
Yeah.
They said, would you like to speak? And I said, sure. They said, what would you like to talk about? I said, I don't know. I've been kind of laid up for a while. So I said, okay. So I purposely did not prepare. I would not let myself write anything. I would not let myself even think about anything. I thought, I'll do it when I get there. So I got there and met with my contact, and then they had me for the president's lunch with all the people saying, you know, they're really looking forward to you talking. And what are you going to talk about? I said, I'm really not sure. And I did know. So they're looking at me like, whoa, you sure this guy's a psychologist? Anyway. So I go over to the hall and I see we don't ever know, you know, whether it's going to be five students or, you know, a lot of students.
Yeah.
But we told them, you know, not just the music and arts department, but drama and the athletic team, like the football team.
Wow.
Olympic sports psychologist? Yeah, football team. No problem. I figured football players not going to come listen to me.
Come listen to a lecture. Right.
I'm thinking I'd get, you know, half the audience. It's a really nice auditorium. It's the biggest one.
Wow.
So I get over there and I'm backstage and just kind of trying to chill and not think anything.
Yeah.
Blank, keep my mind a blank. And that's when the adrenaline hit. I mean, like an explosion. And then I looked out. Standing room only. And they had three people introduce me. The person who contacted me, somebody, and the president. How we're looking forward to this. We don't know what he's going to say, but we're looking forward. So I took my pulse. It's normally about 60, though. It's 145. I thought maybe this wasn't such a good idea after all. So I went out and I said, boy, am I excited. I hate lapel mics. I do not wear a lapel. I blow one away.
Yeah.
Really excited to be here. You might say I'm nervous. You're right. I haven't done anything in 2 months. I don't have any notes. I don't know what I'm talking about. And I said, look, my hands are shaking. They're all wet. I'm about to throw up. I said, I used to have a fear of public speaking. I remember it now. yes. It was awesome. It was really awesome.
That's incredible.
I didn't have any bubbles.
Yeah.
No bubbles. Yeah.
What did you end up talking about? What came to you in that moment?
Just what I was feeling. I mean, because that's what everybody's feeling. That's what everybody wants to talk about. Not, you know, a lecture about the 20 points. It's like, I'm telling you, my hands are shaking.
Yeah. This vulnerability and this openness.
It's one of the best I've ever given.
Amazing. Amazing. Don, what a joy to talk to you, man. This has really, really been great. And like, I don't know how familiar you are with Viola Spolin's work, but she's She's the godmother of improvisation, right? Second City, Chicago, is all based on all the improv schools, all based on her work. She wrote a book called Improv for the Lone Actor, that I took, sort of made a hybrid of that, her stories, her work, and used centering to help find my internal side coach, the voice inside, using little exercises, you know, like all the little, to kind of isolate out of all the noise of the negative self-talk, and then find the voice inside that tells you you're doing it right. Good job. Make a left here. Like little directives.
Yeah.
And to say that's the voice, that's the frequency to listen to and trust that, not all this other static. And,
absolutely.
You know, that, that I ended up teaching a couple classes and a couple like webinars based on that stuff. And it was just transformative and exciting and fun. And it's fun to have to use the word transformative a lot after 50. It's very exciting. But cool. I just wanted to share that with you. And I also wanted to share your website and the classes that you offer to anyone who's listening. You can study with Don, not only your books, but can you talk about what you offer on Winning on Stage?
Sure. Well, my books are there, but also the centering course and also a power learning course that helps artists to learn stuff like how to memorize music and how to accelerate the learning process, because we're always learning. But there's also some assessments where they can check out and see, you know, where they're at in terms of confidence or self-talk and all of those. Yeah. There's a performance mastery assessment. That's my latest, that really would be the one to take.
Awesome.
And it also comes with a half hour session with me.
Awesome.
That it gives a graphic printout like in 20 different categories, but it's not always that easy to read, but in a half an hour, I can not only explain it, but map out a plan for each person of what they need to do. Amazing. You know, get this book, read that book, listen to that tape, those kind of things,
yeah.
So that they know what they need to work on. And it's, and you know, that's going to help them.
Amazing.
So that's, and then I have a bunch of sessions if they want to sign up for more sessions. But a lot of people are really satisfied with just a half hour with me, wow. Which is plenty of time after they take the profile to really say, this is what's going on. You know, your negative self-talk needs to go to positive. You need to build your confidence, you need to learn how to focus, those kind of things in very concrete terms. This is, you know, it's not ethereal. This is not abstract. You need to work on your focus. Yeah. Need to work on switching to right brain.
Yeah.
Those kind of things.
You know, what I really love about our conversation today is how concrete you made these things that feel somewhat esoteric. You know what I mean? Like there's an aspect to the idea of, is there really a right brain and left brain, or do we just call it that? You know what I mean? Like, you know, and working on stuff like self-talk and focus and the psychology and the science behind it is really, has been really important, and something that I'm discovering more and more it's the thing that goes beyond talent. In a way, it is that X factor, right? It's like how you understand and manipulate and use your system to accomplish those goals. And I can't thank you enough for coming in and sharing this. And the website for that is winningonstage.com, right?
Right. Yes.
And then are you on Instagram and Twitter and any of those things, or sort of?
Yeah, there's a Facebook, but I'm just not that active.
I get it.
Yeah,
I've become less and less, but you're quite active on the site. And Don, thank you again so much for spending some time this afternoon.
My pleasure. Really, thank you.
Really,
really
great.
I appreciate it.
You betcha.
Take care.
And thanks so much for listening. This is we'll be back with another episode coming soon. Peace. This has been All Over VoiceOver with Kiff VH, produced by Werewolf Therewolf. Please consider giving the show a positive rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Look, I know I keep asking for a review, but if you found just one piece of info for me or my guests helpful, please share that with me and share it and help grow our VO community. Feel free to catch up with me on Instagram, Twitter, Clubhouse, or Vero at KiffVH, or hit me up on LinkedIn. It's Kiff Vandenhuvel. Just search for Kiff. We probably know a couple of the same people. And check out my website, www.kiffvh.com, for my reels, updates, and to reach out to me directly for coaching or appearances. Claim victory and depart the field. Taxi? Taxi? Ah. I guess I gotta walk from here. Okay.